This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We are live right now in the noon hour on 91.7 FM, but also on the 91.7 WVXU Facebook page if you'd like to view today's show. And not only that, you are also invited to participate by asking questions of us and our guests throughout the hour. Go to 91.7 WVXU on Facebook and watch our live stream there here in the noon hour on this dark and rainy Friday afternoon in the Queen City. Let's start our weekly news review after a busy week in Columbus, which included the expulsion of former House Speaker Larry Householder, the first lawmaker to be removed from the legislature in more than a century and a half. Let's go to Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler and reporter Andy Chow. Karen, welcome back to our program.
Hey, great to be here.
And Andy, welcome to you also.
Michael.
So what was different this week than all the many weeks that preceded it, Karen, that resulted in Larry Householder finally being removed by his fellow lawmakers?
That's a good question. I mean, the action actually happened and there was a vote to remove him. That vote passed 75-21. All but one of those who voted to not expel Householder was a Republican. There was one Democrat who voted and 20 Republicans who voted not to expel him. The other 75 said he had to go. And Householder really did not go down without a fight. I mean, he testified against the bill to expel him in committee, testified personally, stood up on the House floor and testified and said that he shouldn't be removed. Then afterwards, he spoke to reporters as he was being escorted out of the building after he turned in his badge and was removed from the House floor. So it was really a historic moment. This is a man who is the first person in 60 years to have been speaker two separate times. He was Ohio's fourth speaker in a three-year period. And it's just really extraordinary. He's now become the first Ohio representative to be removed from the House since 1857.
By way of a refresher, Andy, tell our listeners again what happened with Larry Householder. This was all tied to that very controversial House Bill 6 related to nuclear energy.
Right. So in 2019, when Larry Householder was Speaker of the House, he was a very vocal supporter of what turned out to be a big sweeping energy bill called HB 6, House Bill 6. It ended up bailing out two nuclear power plants. It ended up doing a whole number of other things when it came to energy issues, repealing renewable energy standards, eliminating energy efficiency standards, helping create and guarantee subsidies for coal plants, a big sweeping energy bill. That was in 2019. About a year later, in July of 2020, Householder was arrested along with some other co-defendants who were lobbyists and political strategists. They were all arrested under an allegation that they took part in a $61 million bribery scheme to get that energy bill passed. So the allegations say that a utility widely believed to be First Energy, located in Akron, that utility is accused of funneling millions and millions of dollars to a dark money group controlled by Householder. Then FBI agents say Householder used that money for personal and political gain to be able to help support allies to get elected into the House, to be able to elect him as Speaker, and then therefore pass HB 6. Those are all the allegations surrounding him. That was in July of 2020. Then from there, after all the allegations and accusations came out, Householder was still reelected in November to remain a representative in the Ohio House. He was running unopposed against some people who were write-in candidates, but he was still reelected.
I want to note that based on the reporting of the Ohio State House News Bureau, Representative Joe Miller, the Democrat from Amherst and the only Democrat to oppose the expulsion of Larry Householder, said in a statement, quote, "If the petition process was not initiated, the political power struggle in the Republican caucus should have been dealt with by defeating Householder in a primary." But Karen, that did not happen. So Householder was already facing these charges and cruised to re-election without any significant opposition. What were some of his fellow Republicans saying now about it apparently being time for Larry Householder to go?
Well, I think it's worth noting, and Andy just did, that Householder was reelected but ran against only write-in candidates. His district was drawn to be Republican. And while he has said, and I think that there's some evidence, that he's fairly popular and well known in his district, there were also real concerns about him. There were letters that were sent to Speaker Bob Kopp by elected officials in his district, elected Republican officials in his district, that had asked Kopp to remove him because he had no committee assignments, and that there was a question about whether he was really representing the district if he really wasn't able to fully participate. But the Republicans who supported him staying on pointed out that he is only accused of crimes in the federal level. There are charges filed against him. He is awaiting trial. He has said that he is innocent. He stood up on the House floor and said he has never taken a bribe or offered a bribe. He has maintained his innocence throughout this. And so if you're presuming innocence before any sort of proof of guilt, well, then, you know, should he be allowed to stay? And Householder himself also says that the definition to remove him is that he had to have committed disorderly conduct. And he says he didn't do that, that he didn't do what most people would consider to be disorderly conduct. Of course, depending on how you define disorderly conduct, I mean, that kind of comes along with when you think about the federal impeachment trial. How do you define crimes, high crimes and misdemeanors, you know? So overwhelmingly, though, I think the pressure was on Speaker Bob Kopp and the other Republicans to remove him because they were getting these letters and these comments from people in his district. And there were also resolutions proposed by Democrats and then two Republicans. This was a Republican resolution that removed him. And I think that that was maybe the final push.
Karen, is there any option for Larry Householder to pursue some type of, I don't know, reprieve or some sort of opportunity to fight this?
If there is, I'm sure he'll try it. I think, you know, as we were asking him outside the House chamber after he was removed about that, and he said he didn't know because, again, this hasn't happened since 1857. But I will say that he is certainly considering and already starting a campaign to make sure that he stays relevant. He's been texting me, for instance, saying that he's got some thoughts on some things that are happening. And he told us all at that event right outside the chamber that he wanted to tour the state. He wanted to keep speaking out on things that were concerning him. He's got a lot of criticisms against, for instance, Governor Mike DeWine. And he said, if you didn't like public citizen Larry Householder, you really won't like private citizen Larry Householder, meaning that he doesn't intend to shut up and go away, I guess.
Andy, what was life like for public citizen Larry Householder? We heard Karen note just moments ago that he had no committee assignments. I mean, what was it like for him in the legislature during this period?
He was a pretty well-silenced member of the Ohio House. He didn't have any committee assignments, and of course, then, therefore, he wasn't chair of a committee. I even think he mentioned that his office was on a different floor than most of the other representatives and most of his other colleagues in the Reif building across the street from the State House. And so he was really there to vote on issues, and he tried to craft bills, but none of them really got any hearings. So he was sort of an isolated member of the Ohio House. And I think it's important to note the role of current Speaker Bob Kopp in all of this. Ever since Kopp took over after Householder was removed as House Speaker last year in 2020, he's been really playing a lot of this close to the chest. He has not talked a lot about how expulsion was going to happen, if it would happen at all. And then leading up to the day Householder was expelled, Kopp would talk to us, talk to some of the reporters and said, listen, you'll see how all of this plays out sooner rather than later. And then when the vote was held, all of a sudden you got a little more glimpse about what Bob Kopp thought about the whole thing. And I think what you could tell from all those internal meetings for the House Republican caucus, there was a huge rift. There were people who absolutely did not want to see Householder go. There were people who said that they just couldn't see the House operating in a function unless Householder were to leave. So there is a big distraction component to all of this. And that's what you heard from people on the House floor who wanted to expel Householder, that they thought just his mere presence was a distraction and really sort of an affront to the possibility of restoring public trust.
You all listening have heard us mention that this expulsion was the first in Columbus since 1857. Let's go back there. There's an interesting piece of information about it at the conclusion of this coverage by Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. The only state rep to be expelled was John Slough, a Democrat. How do you say it?
Sure.
You know what? It's O. Exactly.
I've
you know,
all of, slough, but yeah.
All of us who speak English know that O U G H can be pronounced 1,000 different ways. It could be slough, slough, slough. I'm going to go with slough. I'm going to take a chance here. John Slough. He was a Democrat from right here in Hamilton County who punched Republican Darius Cadwell on the House floor back in January of 1857 and was expelled. He went on to fight in the Civil War, ended up as Chief Justice of the New Mexico Territory. So there is evidence that there is something on the other side of this for someone expelled. However, we should note that Slough was assassinated by a member of that territorial legislature 10 years after being expelled from the Ohio legislature. Again, we're joined by Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler and reporter Andy Chow. Let's talk about more things out of Columbus this week. Karen, I understand that there's something going on with the budget that looks to me, as far as the headline goes, to be good news. We're talking about a big surplus.
Yeah. And I think for a lot of people, as we were starting the budget process just a couple of months ago, we're still in the pandemic. There was a lot of concern about what the pandemic was going to do to Ohio's economy. If you'll remember a year ago when unemployment was in the double digits in March and April of last year and schools were closed, everything was on lockdown. There was a real concern about what that was going to do to Ohio's budget. And now we're at the tail end of the two-year budget cycle, getting ready to start a new budget cycle. And with all this COVID money that has come to both individuals and also to the state and local communities, there's a lot more money than anybody expected. The state was expecting to be in about a $2 billion deficit at this point. Looks like we've got a $1.1 billion surplus. So that's potentially a $3 billion swing here that was unanticipated. While that's great news, the governor's office is now cautioning state lawmakers who really, really, really like tax cuts that doing tax cuts right now with that money would be potentially a bad idea because this is one-time money. This is not money that we're expecting to get every year. And so obligating the state to a different tax level might be a real problem. And so that's going to be, I think, one of the discussion points.
So there will be plenty of discussion to be had about this money then, Karen?
Oh, yeah. And of course, everybody's got ideas on how to spend money. I mean, you've got people saying that they could use that money to fund schools and do that school funding formula and the complexities there. The governor's saying, hey, what about his H2 Ohio cleanup of Lake Erie? You know, there's all sorts of ideas. It'll be something to watch to see where they end up going with it.
Andy, as far as money goes, another issue was raised, and it's related to the state's municipal tax rule. And some people from local governments are trying to fight a proposed change. Would you mind telling us what that proposed change is and what the beef is?
Definitely. So what happened last year, of course, when things were shut down and everybody had to stay at their home and work from home, there was a change in the rules for Ohio where even though, let's say, you're working at a home in a neighborhood outside of Cincinnati, but your office is usually in the city of Cincinnati proper, then your company is still paying municipal taxes to that city, even though you're not currently located within the city of Cincinnati while you are working. Now, usually when people work from home and then their company withholds taxes, they can seek a refund on those taxes. And so the rule said last year during the pandemic, because of the state of emergency, that people who were working from home could not seek refunds on the taxes that were withheld in their paycheck for those municipal income taxes. Now, a change in the budget changes that rule, retroactively changes that rule to say, yes, if you were working from home, yet the city that you usually work at from the office withheld some taxes, you can seek a refund. That comes as a big blow and a big shock to a lot of city leaders who were relying on that municipal income tax that was already pulled from paychecks to use in their budget. So this is going to be a big fight. And we're talking about how cities and city leaders have budgeted based on municipal tax income. And now all of a sudden, the state government saying that workers can seek a refund on those taxes, that's a big shakeup.
So what you're saying, Andy, is if you live in Cincinnati, but let's say your office was in Blue Ash, and that's where your local tax is taken out of your paycheck, you can ask Blue Ash for a refund.
Yeah, under the Senate budget proposal, if it passes, that's the way it could happen. Right now, you're not allowed to ask for a refund only from 2020. And that measure, that rule is going to be lifted once the state of emergency is lifted, which happens to also be today as well. So there's also a question of what can workers do for the rest of 2021.
Let's talk a bit about sports gambling. That's another hot topic for many months now. We've heard about this, Karen, but the Senate looks like they like it.
Yeah, overwhelmingly passed, 30-2. And the only person who abstained was Matt Dolan, whose family has an ownership stake in the Cleveland Indians. But what's interesting about this bill, and I'm getting ready, I just posted a story at our website, statenews.org, about this. I'm getting ready to tweet it out. There's language in this bill that limits the type of sports licenses that for those brick and mortar sports books, limits those to only counties that have 100,000 or more residents, and limits them to a maximum of three. And sports teams, as well as casinos and racinos, can apply for those sports books. And the way the limits are set, if the pro sports teams in Cincinnati and Cleveland all apply for those brick and mortar sports books, not just the mobile apps, but apply for the brick and mortar sports books, that could potentially shut out the casinos in those cities, the casinos in Cincinnati and Cleveland, from getting brick and mortar sports books, which is probably not what the casinos were hoping for. In fact, almost certainly is not what they were hoping for. So there's some work to do on this bill that's now gone over to the House to try to figure out what's going to happen as it moves through.
Is there any sense of how the House feels about it and if it would go into some sort of reconciliation process?
Well, the House last year passed a bill that would not give the Ohio Casino Control Commission the authority to regulate sports betting, but gave it to the Ohio Lottery. So that's been the real push and pull back and forth this whole time. The House has said that the lottery should control sports gambling in the state, while the Senate has said that Casino Control Commission should have the authority. So that's going to have to be worked out. And now with this kind of a limit here, potentially shutting out some casinos from having brick and mortar sports books, this could be really, really difficult. And this is something that Ohio's lawmakers have wanted to get done, because there's only one state in our surrounding area that doesn't have sports gambling besides us. I think that's Kentucky. And so, you know, there's a lot of all the other states have already legalized this. So Ohio is kind of late to the game here.
We're talking with Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler and reporter Andy Chow. We've been talking a lot in recent weeks about redistricting in all of the states in our listening area and what a challenge that always is, especially on a partisan level. And I was interested to read in your reporting, Karen, that policy issues are added to budgets all the time. And I didn't know that.
Yeah.
And there is one policy issue being tucked in the Senate budget proposal right now that would bring some sort of litigation opportunity to the redistricting process. Could you explain?
Sure. And on that issue of policy issues being thrown into budgets, the budget has to pass. There's no option to not pass the budget. And so quite often you'll see things thrown in there. There have been abortion access restrictions that have been put into budgets. Governor DeWine tried to put in some gun regulations into his version of the budget. This happens quite often. It's not unusual. But this particular proposal in the Senate would allow only the Senate president and the House speaker, who currently right now are Republicans, to hire outside counsel if there is a dispute over how the maps are drawn, and that dispute goes to the Ohio Supreme Court. Typically, the Ohio Attorney General would be the one that would be the lawyer for the state to intervene in that. But this particular proposal would allow only those two leaders, again, who are right now Republicans, to intervene in a Supreme Court challenge, which would almost certainly come from Democrats, because Republicans are the majority. They're going to be the ones who are drawing the maps for Congress, as well as the Ohio House and Senate. Minority party has more buy-in because voters approved that in two constitutional amendments in 2015 and 2018, but it's still likely that the maps will be challenged in court.
And I see that you spoke with Jen Miller of the League of Women Voters, who has been a guest on this program multiple times talking about this. She's not happy about the way that's moving.
Yeah, in fact, we were in a forum at the City Club of Cleveland, if I can promote that, where I was moderating this discussion. And yeah, there's a lot of concern about how these maps are going to be drawn, and of course, the timeline here. And of course, we're going to lose a seat in Congress. So we go from 16 members of Congress to 15. That's going to be a big deal. Who actually does lose their congressional district, how those districts are then redrawn.
Let's go back to Andy Chow now. I understand that there's some difficulties for low-income Ohioans who are concerned about potential cuts to SNAP benefits?
Right. So SNAP benefits, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, often referred to as food stamps. Right now, the state of Ohio and what I'm told every state in the country uses a waiver that allows the states to bypass what are federal limits on assets. And so what the federal government says is if you're going to get SNAP benefits, then they're going to limit your liquid assets and limit your vehicle assets. But every state, including Ohio, has decided to waive that measure because they don't think that it's appropriate. However, in the Senate, they added an amendment to the budget to once again enforce those limitations. So anybody who receives SNAP benefits could not have a vehicle that's valued over $4,600. And that's a pretty low threshold, according to low-income family advocates. And so what they're saying here is that this is just another hurdle that's going to be attached to people who are trying to get assistance or are trying to use this safety net for food. And then they start to have to worry about, are they going to have to get rid of their car in order to stay as someone who can still receive SNAP benefits? So this is going to be something that's going to be a big fight when the Senate and the House come together to finalize a budget. And a lot of people who advocate for low-income Ohioans believe this is something that Governor Mike DeWine can't be happy with as well. So it's also a potential line item veto for him.
You can hear Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporting here on 91.7 WVXU and always check it out at statenews.org. My thanks to Bureau Chief Karen Kassler and reporter Andy Chow for spending part of your Friday with us. We always appreciate when you show up for us. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Juneteenth.
And up next, warnings about a teenager in juvenile detention were reportedly ignored before that teen died. We'll hear what other young inmates had to say about it. And how a 1987 local cicada story went all around the world, but wasn't entirely accurate. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. A teenager died at an Ohio juvenile detention facility, and other young inmates claim they suspected a problem. Inquirer reporter Cameron Knight joins us via Zoom now. Cameron, welcome back to Cincinnati Edition.
Hello, good afternoon.
This is a very sad story. Let's start by, if you don't mind, telling us who 17-year-old Robert Wright was.
Yeah, Robert Wright was a 17-year-old who was from Hamilton County. His family was from the Lockland area. He was incarcerated. Incarcerated is probably not the right word, but he was adjudicated delinquent in a case back when he was 14, I believe. And he eventually found himself in Circleville Juvenile Correction Facility. Circleville is one of three juvenile correction facilities, which are kind of imagine juvenile jail, basically. People live there. There are cells. There are guards. They call them youth specialists. But when you think of a juvenile jail or juvenile prison, this is probably about as close as you're going to get to it. There are many different rules that apply to these facilities than adult prisons, but it's sort of the closest thing you'll find in Ohio. And he was there. He was set to get out last November and come home to his family. But he in August, he died. He was found dead in his cell.
And it took some time, Cameron, for the family to learn anything about what happened to their son while he was away.
Right. And I think that's one of the things that drew me to this story was it was the Department of Youth Services, which operates the facility, put out a press release the day or two after he passed and said he was found unconscious in his cell. And that was about it. They indicated that there was little to no indication of foul play, but it took months and months and months to figure out what happened at all. And then even now, there are still major open questions about what actually led to his death.
And a lot of questions about who knew what might have been going on with him, or that there was obviously some sort of problem going on with him. I understand, based on your reporting, Cameron, that 5 months after 17-year-old Robert Wright of Hamilton County was found dead inside his cell at the Circleville Juvenile Correction Facility, that it was noted in the autopsy report that the cause was amphetamine intoxication with contributing congenital cardiovascular disease. What do we know about the veracity of that at this point?
So there's two, that statement actually wraps up the two major questions that remain in this case. In his toxicology screens that they performed after his death, there was amphetamine found in his system. It was, according to the experts who did all this stuff, it was a low dose. It was not an overdose-sized dose. So when these coroners perform autopsies, if it's a overdose, they see a certain level of amphetamine in a system. In this case, it was not that level. It was a much, much lower level. They to this day still do not know where those drugs came from. That's the one major question. The second major question is that there was a congenital heart problem, with Mr. Wright. He had a heart problem, and he had for months, or at least a month, had been complaining to the health staff at the facility that he was struggling to breathe and having heart pain and like chest pains. And there's an open question about if that was handled properly, if his complaints were taken seriously, if he'd gone through all the proper channels of, you know, when he was supposed to see a doctor versus a telehealth visit. All of those questions are still open.
But you report that there were some scheduled appointments. He died on August 31st, but had an appointment with a nurse on August 17, had a telemedicine appointment on August 21. And then, according to your reporting, Cameron, on August 30, the day before he was found dead, a youth specialist heard another staff member leaving Robert's room tell the boy, "I'm not sure what's going on, but you need to sign up for a health call." So was it unclear whether he followed through with any of those appointments?
He was scheduled. It seems like he did those things. What is unclear is like how it escalated. If he ever actually was seen by a doctor in person, if that would have done any good, if the policies that DYS has set up for these facilities, was it dictated that he should have been seeing a doctor, and that was because of the pandemic, perhaps not followed. Those are all the open questions that we still have. But the crux of the story, I've written many stories about this so far. The crux of the most recent story is that despite it taking 5 months for anyone to learn anything about what happened outside of a few select people inside of the Department of Youth Services who are conducting an investigation, outside of those people, no one knew anything for at least 5 months. But the other teens who were being held in the facility with Robert Wright were interviewed immediately. Within 2 days, they were interviewed. And several of them remarked that they didn't take his health problem seriously and that he could have still been here if they had.
Have you heard from Robert's family?
Yeah, we've been talking to his mother, whose name is Cassandra Wright, and she's been going up to protest, and she's been looking for information. There have been two reports that have been issued on the death. There was a death investigation performed by the Ohio State Highway Patrol, and then there was another internal investigation with DYS, and they, when they released their findings, which included that there were people who weren't awake when they should have been awake, who should have been conducting rounds at the night he died. So they had the possibility to have perhaps found him sooner had there not been people literally asleep on the job. They also found that there was no one, the CPR certifications of many of the staff. They're all required to be CPR certified. Many of those certifications had lapsed because of COVID. There's a lot of things that they found in that report, but they also announced that they were going to basically scrap the top end of their medical staff. The medical director for all of DYS was removed from his position. The chief physician at Circleville was also, his contract was not renewed. They're bringing in other people to do oversight. But despite all of that, I have asked DYS repeatedly, what about this case led you to do that? And the summation of all of our conversations were basically, we found opportunities for improvement. They have not said if or what, if anything went wrong in Robert's case, in terms of policy or procedures.
I want to share one of the quotes that you included in your report, Cameron. Quote, "I have a lot of time to think about this stuff because that's all I do is think about it. When I have no more questions, that's when I'll be done." You can read Cameron Knight's reporting on this issue and other similar issues at Cincinnati.com. He is our guest here on Cincinnati Edition today. You can also watch today's broadcast live on 91.7 WVXU Facebook page. Cameron Knight, you had probably the most fascinating story of the week. I was gripped by a cicada story, and longtime listeners of this program know I'm a little icked out by them. I'm not a big fan of the cicadas, but you had a fascinating, historic cicada story. The cicadas that we're seeing now, of course, they had grandparents back in 1987, two cicada invasions ago. And there was a situation that went all around the world, like the 1980s equivalent of viral. Turns out, not completely accurate, that a woman in Cincinnati was robbed at cicada point, as if a cicada had been wielded as a weapon. You track this woman down all these decades later. Tell us who she is and what the story was.
Yeah, so I go through the archives of our newspaper all the time. And another editor actually stumbled across the story. Her name's Cheryl Vary. She's been around. She's been a pivotal journalist in Cincinnati for decades. And she found this story and was like, here you go. This is, sounds right up your alley. And I said, you're right. And I found that they named her in the story, Markeisha. So Markeisha Kellogg, and she was named in the story, which was odd for kind of a wire story of that nature for her to be named, but she was. And, you know, as journalists do, we have access to databases and ways to find people's phone numbers. And I bet I called 6 to 8 phone numbers, most of which were disconnected. And then I finally get someone on the phone that answers. And she says, I say, is Markeisha Kellogg there? And she says, no, nope. And I'm like, oh, I must have the wrong number. And she said, well, what do you want to talk to her about? And I said, well, I'm a reporter with the Inquirer. And I found this story from the 1980s that mentions Markeisha. And I just thought it would be fun to talk to her about it. And she goes, oh, the cicadas? And I knew exactly that I had someone who at least knew her. And it turned out to be her sister.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Who was being a little skeptical, reasonably so, of someone just randomly calling to talk to her sister. But Markeisha agreed to speak with me.
And I'm glad she did, because you got to alert a lot of us who, you know, don't remember 1987 and to revisit this story. So let's first tell our audience what the audience was told in 1987 about what went down at a local chili parlor or local restaurant.
So at least 60 newspapers ran this story. I was told that a bunch of magazines ran it. It was all over the country. It was like a viral story. So two armed men with a cicada are suspected of stealing $25 from a restaurant's cash register after using the winged insect to scare away the cashier, police say. The two men walked into the Grand Slam restaurant, which was located in Madisonville, brandishing a cicada. They thrust the bug at the cashier, Markeisha Kellogg, 22, who fled from her post. And she later returned to the cash register to find the money missing.
Okay.
And that was what was presented to the entire country.
And you can understand why that would circulate. People are generally fascinated by cicada and the idea that one would be wielded as a weapon, brandished, as they wrote in that report, is fascinating. So the curiosity is understandable for a little wire copy in the inside of a newspaper. But when you talk to Markeisha Kellogg, she tells you not exactly what happened.
No, she said one of the first things she said was, "Do you want the truth or do you want the lie?" And from that moment on, I had to know what happened. So she said that she was working at this place and she was outside with her friend, and she decided to play a prank on her friend. She grabbed a bunch of cicadas up and threw them on his back, and he screamed and ran off. And then a couple customers showed up. So she went into the store. These were people she knew, her friend outside, somebody she knew, the two people that came in to eat, people she knew. And she was at the cash register. She gave him some cheese conies, she said, and she was cashing them out. And that's when her friend decided to come in and get his revenge. And he had a fistful of cicadas and threw them straight into her face. And she took off because it was a huge amount of them right in her face. And she took off. And then when she came back to the register, she said she didn't even realize that she'd left it open. When she came back, she saw that the money was disturbed. She was apparently very particular about having the money very straight and lined up. And she said she saw the money was disturbed. And she asked the men at the counter, "What the heck? Did you guys take any money from the register?" And they said no. And she counted it out in front of them, the whole register out in front of them, and saw that she was $25 short. And they still denied it. And she said, "Well, if you're going to deny it, I'm calling the cops." And she did. She called 911. And then she said that this officer just somehow conflated the two stories together in his police report. And that's what ended up circulating all over the country.
Right, so the police officer was apparently amused by this and may have gotten the details a little mixed up, is what it sounds
like. Right. That's what it sounds like. And she said she's pretty sore. I'm to this day still a little sore about this story.
She said she'd want to find him and sue him.
Yeah. She said that she'd sue him for half his pension if she could figure out who it was. And she, you know, her friends apparently give her a really hard time about it. And one of her friends has made t-shirts with cicadas on them and still gives her a hard time about it to this day. She just had such a great attitude about all of it and was happy to set the record straight, I think. And, so I mean, at the best, it was a cicada assisted robbery, but it seems like a crime of opportunity.
I love that she concludes by telling you she's not afraid of cicadas, especially just one of them. So, face full of any bug is enough to freak somebody out. I totally agree. So,
And when we sent our photographer out there to take pictures of her, she has pictures of, she's holding the cicadas. And my favorite thing was she said, "The only thing I'm scared of is something with eight legs. You can have the whole restaurant if you have eight legs."
Well, justice for Markeisha after all these years, thanks to Inquirer reporter Cameron Knight. Cameron, thanks so much for spending part of your Friday with us. We really appreciate it.
Thanks so much. Have a great day.
You too. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. As part of our new community storytelling initiative, Round the Corner, WVXU is shining a light on the people, businesses, history, and events that make Greater Cincinnati a fascinating place to live, work, and raise a family. WVXU's Jolene Almendarez has been spending time in Roselawn, home to about 7,000 people.
She's up there killing the weeds. She's spraying them. Can't you see the glitter?
It's a Saturday morning, and Roselawn Community Council trustees are pulling weeds, picking up cans, and getting rid of garbage along Reading Road. Council trustee Carla Foster has a weed sprayer strapped to her back.
I love Roselawn. I really do. And it used to be a destination spot because I grew up in Avondale. So growing up, it was like, this is where you wanted to move to. And I did. And now, not the way it was.
She says apartment buildings in the area used to be immaculate. There was a local butcher shop, Jewish community center, jazz bars and restaurants in the neighborhood's central business district. But over the years, those places have closed or moved elsewhere. Now, community council trustees are focused on attracting those kinds of places back to Roselawn by zeroing in on three main issues: urban blight, crime, and business, which they say are intertwined. Kim O'Brien is the community council secretary.
Oh, well, some of the big issues that are happening here in the community is we have a lot of drug violence and, you know, a lot of crime. So there's a lot of drugs being sold and used, like, right on the street.
Last year, Roselawn ranked 6th out of Cincinnati's 52 neighborhoods for shootings. Council President Carol Smith is trying to convince the city to install ShotSpotter in the neighborhood. The system uses sensors to closely pinpoint where a gun is fired. Community council trustees also want cameras installed in areas where residents often report seeing illegal dumping and drug deals. And neighbors also suspect sex workers are active along Redding Road. Residents and business owners have complained about suspected sex work in the area to city officials.
We've been working with District 4 to try to alleviate the prostitution that goes along in this neighborhood on Redding Road. And working with District 4 to try to resolve some of the problems in the neighborhood.
Community council trustees say if they can get a handle on crime and keep the corridor clean, they can attract businesses back and the area can thrive again.
We're working toward that goal with the other municipalities to bring some development into this area.
Despite the problems, Kim O'Brien and the other women at the beautification effort say Roselawn is overall an ideal place to live.
That's why I really love the community, because there are changes. They're slow, but there are changes in the community. But we need more changes for the citizens in the community, and we need more people that care about where they live.
The cleanup crew says they're always eager for more helping hands. Jolene Almendarez, 91.7 WVXU.
And now Jolene Almendarez joins us via Zoom to talk more about this series and Roselawn. Hi, Jolene. Happy Friday.
Yeah, happy Friday, Michael. Thanks for having me on.
So this area, Roselawn, was the first to be featured in our new Round the Corner storytelling initiative. And you're a transplant here. We brought you to town to work here for us. Tell us, just in general, what it was like to get to know one particular part of the area so intimately during this process.
Oh, it was so fun. And so, you know, just to kind of like play off of the Round the Corner thing, the idea behind it is that, you know, coverage, you know, we have so much news coming out of City Hall and particular areas of the city. I think the idea was to kind of branch out and see what else is going on, see what we're missing, right? And so being new to Cincinnati, they thought, you know, send her out there, see what she can find. And it was so much fun. I got to meet the nicest people. I really got to just really discover an area. I even have a little mystery that I never really got to the bottom of about why there's a giant well on the Redding Road corridor. And it was just so much fun to kind of like talk to people about how they're living, why they're living there. And it actually made me a little homesick too. It made me miss the city, San Antonio, where I'm from, and kind of all the quirks there.
Wait, there was a giant what that you're still confused by?
A giant well.
It may have been like
a big former well where people used to tie up their horses. And apparently it may have been like a toll booth, like in the olden days. Like every mile that you kind of went down this roadway, you'd have to sort of pay a toll with your little horses. I'm talking about like a long time ago though, right? But
we do not have any of this confirmed. You're saying it on the air. You're just speculating that you had to pay a toll.
No, I talked to a historian, but it was hard to like really get to the bottom of it. And he looked at my photos and was able to pull some interesting information, but I just didn't really have enough to put a story out there. And those are the kinds of things we're looking for, though. So,
yeah, well, you know, it sounds
anyone
like
knows more about that. Well, for goodness sake.
Well, that sounds like a mystery for Bill Reinhart and his OK, I Want to Know series. And what we could do is we could do a crossover episode of Round the Corner and OK, I, like they used to do with sitcoms in the 90s. Perhaps that's something that we can look into.
I love crossover.
Absolutely. So you got to meet a lot of people. You got to cover a lot of different angles about this community in Roselawn. You did profile some Vietnamese refugees who created a restaurant there. Tell us a little bit about them and their place.
Oh, yeah. So the place is called Song Long. And basically was able to talk to a woman who came from Vietnam. This was after the Vietnam War with her husband, and how they were able, they actually had a restaurant in Vietnam. And then when they came here to the United States, they worked in restaurants and in time were able to kind of start their own restaurants. And it's one of those places where the whole family works there. You know the people who go in, and the food is just really authentic. I believe she's in her 80s still, and she's still out back there making food every single day, working like over 50 hours a week because she wants to. She wants to kind of keep this family tradition alive. And there are so many people who even now who come in to visit, you know, people, some of the children, and they'll come in to visit. I think one came in from Germany and still helped pick up a few shifts and helped run the place. And it was so heartwarming to kind of hear that story and hear how the community has supported them for all these years.
Well, the community is quite diverse. Roselawn Academy has got a focus on multilingual immersion studies, I understand. Or the Academy of Multilingual Immersion Studies located in Roselawn, I should have said, to be more clear.
Right, exactly. And there, that's where kids go. They speak two languages. Some classes are done all in Spanish. Some classes are done all in English. And they kind of bring these kids in. And some of the kids there, it's a 50-50 mix. Some of the kids there speak primarily Spanish at home and are sort of learning English as a second language. And some of the kids there speak primarily English at home and are learning Spanish as a second language. And they kind of pair these kids up so they can help each other and figure it out. And I got to talk to some students who go there who'd been there for years and just are having so much fun and really love the opportunity to kind of meet new people and learn new things. It's and I was surprised to hear one person pretty young, like, a young boy who was talking about how he loves to travel and can't wait to like speak Spanish in these other places. It was so cool.
We've got more on Round the Corner at our website, wvxu.org. You can find all of these reports that Jolene did for us in the first series, and there will be many more to come as we make our way around the greater Cincinnati region. Jolene, before I let you go, I suppose I would be remiss if we did not wish a happy birthday to a very good boy.
Thank you, my beagle Grant. He turned 5 years old on the 15th, so we're having a big barbecue, rain or shine, at my friend's house. There will be other dogs. I bought all the other dogs doggy bags with little like treats and toys in it. It's going to be quite a little blowout.
Now, I know that people from Texas can be barbecue snobs. Is Grant a barbecue snob?
He really is. Everyone at the party is going to be eating hamburgers and veggie burgers, and he actually is getting a ribeye steak. So
oh,
he is
wow.
very snobby.
What a good boy indeed. Happy birthday to Grant the Beagle, who we see a lot of on Jolene Almendarez's Twitter feed. Jolene, thanks so much for spending a little bit of Grant's birthday in this Friday with us. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And all of you listening, congratulations. We've made it to Friday. A little rainy out there, though. But thank you so much for spending so much of your week with Cincinnati Edition, where our producer is Selena Reeder. Our assistant producer is Nick Swartzel. Our technical director is Josh Elstro. And the producer of our Facebook live feed is Ronnie Salerno. I'm Michael Monks. We'll talk again on Monday.